Support this podcast and keep us going. Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join up.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 780. Today, Melissa asks,
on self-doubt, how do you deal with it? Starting to think I'm never going to be good enough to make a living at this, and I'm just wasting time, energy, and money on something that I'm going to fail at.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we've all been there. this is not an unusual thing for...
What Melissa is talking about is called imposter syndrome, and everybody has it. I mean, everybody. If you've ever read Neil Gaiman's blog, there's a blog post from a couple of years back where he talks about having met Neil Armstrong and how both of them felt quite out of their depth at a party because of the perceived accomplishments of everybody else in the room. And Gaiman wrote that if Neil Armstrong felt like an imposter, maybe everyone did.
Yeah.
I'm going to include that blog post if I can find it in the show notes, but literally everybody who does anything has imposter syndrome.
No, I had, like almost everybody who grew up in the 80s, I had a significant period of deep devotion to U2. And in the movie Rattle and Hum, when they were at the beginning of their reign as the top concert draw in the world, with the exception of Neil Diamond and the Rolling Stones, who both knocked them off the perch occasionally from the late 80s through the early 2000s. Rattle and Hum is a documentary about the first tour in this reign of terror over the music industry. And there's this point at which Bono and the Edge are walking along the streets of Harlem, and they come across a street musician who's doing a one-man band thing, playing some street blues, and he's really good. And the camera whips around, and right before it cuts, you see there's this look on their faces saying, oh my God, we're never going to be that good. Top concert draws in the world at the time, looking at a street performer who's busking and going, oh my God, I'm never going to be that good. That's actually pretty healthy, at least if you keep it in check, because it keeps you hungry. To extend the U2 analogy, they stopped being hungry after about 2002, and it really, really shows in their music. And you see this with a lot of people who've been on top for too long. Most of them stop being hungry, and the quality of the work declines. So being able to harness that sense of personal inadequacy can actually be really useful, but like a wild horse or a wild buffalo, you better harness it or it can trample you to death. This is a hard game. The arts are one of the hardest businesses in the world, because in any business, in any customer-facing business especially, there's only so much you can control. It's very like being in an ecosystem and being somewhere in the middle of the food chain. You're subject to everything. The movements of big and small players in the market, the whims and tastes of the customers, the cultural and political situation, all of these things affect the market and affect your marketability and affect what you have to do to get to the market in ways that you can't control. The best you can hope to do is adapt to them, or to create yourself a small island of stability in a sea of troubles. The author communities that we talked about a few days ago, that's creating your island of stability in the sea of troubles. Adapting to the marketplace, that's what I was talking about. That's what I was talking about in the pay-to-play episode. So, to bring this back to the individual level, what can you control aside from all that stuff? You can control how good your work is, how much you're putting out to a certain extent, how much you're improving in your craft, how good your creative churn is. See the episode on Mastering Your Own Destiny and on Beating Writer's Block for that. And you can control how in touch with your market segment you are, which will help you with publishing strategy. That's your wheelhouse. You can't control anything outside of that. It's rather foolish to even try. That's when the wild horse gets loose and tramples all over you and demoralizes you. The thing about any business, any business, you hear about this in the arts, but it's actually true in any business, is somewhere upwards of 70% of success is simply persistence. The consequences of bad judgment and bad luck weed out so many people so early on. The number of people who finish a book at all is exceedingly small. The number of people who get past the first couple of books, smaller still. The more books you get under your belt, a few things happen. Number one, you get a better chance of being noticed organically. More than that, when you are noticed organically, the fact that you have a lot of books, especially if they look good and current and that sort of thing, the fact that you have a lot of books instantly ups your credibility in the mind of the prospective customer. And it ups your credibility in the eyes of your peers. So it's a lot easier to get someone to review, someone above you in the food chain in the marketplace, to review or blurb one of your books, or in fact to get a review blog or a news outlet to review one of your books, if you have a good, deep bibliography. That ups your credibility, gives you a foot in the door. It doesn't actually kick the door in. It just gives you enough of a gap to slide your credit card in and jimmy the latch loose. It's a tough game. It's always been a tough game. And there have been times where it's been easier than others. And unfortunately for all of us, like I said the other day, we all got in at a point where it was suddenly easy for the first time in decades. And that window's closed now. And it's probably not going to open back up. Not unless and until there's an antitrust action against Amazon. Which will probably happen, but I think we're going to wait a while for it. Or until Amazon screws up and tumbles off its perch, or until the vertically integrated media companies start divesting because their new business plan isn't working out the way they hoped. All of these things will eventually happen. The question is when. Will it happen in the next 10 years? Meh, maybe. In the next 5? Eh, I doubt it. Within my lifetime, assuming that I don't get killed in an accident, yeah, probably. Within your lifetime, assuming you're younger than me, definitely. But that's a pretty large window of uncertainty. So, you've got to focus where your focus will do some good. You've got to focus on your craft and your art. They're not the same thing. On your artistic health, like I was talking about with the Avoiding Writer's Block episode and some other recent ones that we'll link in the show notes. And on your connection with your audience. Treat your audience like gold. It really makes a difference. The times in my life when I've been able to do that, incredible response. The times when I haven't been able to do that, you can really see the difference. Major, major difference. The audience members that care enough to reach out to you are the audience members that can, not necessarily will, but can have the capacity to drive your books into the mainstream, because they're the ones that care enough to write to you. It's more likely that they're going to be the ones that care enough to evangelize for you. You want to treat them like gold. Those are the people you're looking for. Now, it's only going to be a certain percentage of them that are also motivated to go and evangelize. But it's those evangelists that you want, and you want excuses for those evangelists to get involved. So, that's the name of the game. Keep your focus where it can do some good. And find yourself a first reader that will be honest with you, but that really does love your work. Or at least love the kind of work you're doing. It's hard to find someone who'd do both, right? It's hard to find someone who loves your work enough to tell you when it's bad. That's what you want. Love your work enough to tell you when it's not working. Because they are interested primarily in being transported by what you've done, and they're not quite so bound up by what you'll think about their reaction. You need someone you can trust like that. Takes a while to find people like that sometimes, but you can do it. I'm sorry this isn't as coherent as my responses normally are, but I've just got a scattershot of ideas that your question has induced. Self-doubt is a killer, and like Kitty said, we all go through it. The thing is, when you're doubting yourself, you're usually holding yourself up to an inarticulable ideal. When you say, I'm not good enough, the question you ought to come back with is, good enough for what? By what standard? If you're the kind of person who can't let that go, then you need to concretize it and conquer it. I, for example, am not good enough. By what standard? Well, my sales suck right now. Okay, but what kind of control do I have over them? Well, not as much as I'd like, obviously. What can I do about it? Well, there's a few things I can do, so I'm finally starting to do them. I've finally got the space in my life to actually do them. What other things am I not good enough at? Well, there's writers who I'd like to be able to blow out of the water artistically that I can't yet. That gives me a goal. Self-doubt is a killer so long as it's abstract. The trick with so many things that trip us up mentally is that they're abstract. The more you can concretize something, the more you can figure out if there's any actual data there, or if it's just despair. Despair is no fun. Despair is its own problem. But the thing about humans is that we're not rational creatures. We're rationalizing creatures. So if we feel a certain way, we cast about for a reason, just so that we can pin it down and have some order to our mental lives. The reason doesn't have to be true. And self-doubt is one of those things. Everybody feels it because when you're operating artistically, you're operating in a vast field of unknowns. So the very fact that you're in an unknown arena, that you're exploring creative space, which is, despite the number of artists that have existed, is largely unmapped. And it's certainly unmapped for you because you haven't walked through the vast creative plane yet. When you're exploring that creative space, you're in a realm of uncertainty, you feel uneasy. Well, that means you're going to feel like a failure. You're going to feel like a faker because you imagine that the people ahead of you must feel very confident because a person who isn't confident wouldn't get there. That's not true. As Bill Goldman, the most successful screenwriter in history, wrote The Princess Bride, among other things, one of the most prolific, too. As Bill Goldman said when asked what it takes to make a good screenplay, he said, no one knows anything. The nature of the arts is that no one knows anything when it comes to the questions that everybody asks. That's the reason everybody's asking them. We all know, or can learn, what makes a good story. We all know and can learn the mathematical mechanics of music. We all know or can learn the geometry involved in architecture and visual arts. What we can't know and can't learn except through experimentation that is always going to be imperfect and highly context-dependent is what it takes to be great, what it takes to be successful, what it takes to be a master of the universe. Well, those things aren't knowable because the conditions for them change all the time. And the people who are most successful at it, who become those things, are the people who are doing the stuff that's absolutely crazy that no one's ever done before. The problem is, the people who are the greatest failures as artists, at least the ones that stick around and do the art, they're also the ones who are out on that edge and who are doing crazy experiments, but their experiments never pan out. That kind of situation is enough to make anyone crazy, and we react to it by doubting ourselves. And doubting ourselves in rather destructive ways, by doubting that we have the right to do this, if we're good enough people. If we're good enough people, am I a good enough person to be an artist? Well, if you know anything about the history of the arts, you know that a good personhood is not a prerequisite to being a great artist. In fact, it often gets in the way. If you're a good person and you want to be a great artist, you've got a little bit of a harder road ahead of you than someone who's an absolutely awful person, because absolutely awful people tend to be less inhibited in exactly the ways that's necessary for brilliant feats of creativity. It's one of the perverse realities of life. Doesn't mean that a good person cannot be a great artist. That's also happened. It's just a little less frequent. But our brains latch on to rationalizations. If this isn't working, I must not be good enough. Well, no. You might be good enough. Not that you can't always be better, because we all can. But you might be good enough, but you haven't found your audience yet. You might be good enough, but the timing is wrong for the kind of books you write. If you wrote spy novels in the early 2000s, you had no career at all. You could have been the best spy novel writer in the history of the planet, and no one would have bought your books, because everyone was tired of the Cold War and it didn't seem relevant anymore and espionage seemed like a distant memory. Fast forward a few years to global uncertainty ramping up, Edward Snowden revealing the depth of spying going on in the universe and other stuff like that, boom! Suddenly, spy novels are big again. And a lot of people who honed their chops really hard during the lean times because they were working in an impossible situation and trying like hell to be the next Robert Ludlum anyway, suddenly, whew, the tide comes up and the boats that they've been building float really well and they become the new bestsellers. Life is like that, which leads me to the big secret here. You're not required to have an opinion of yourself. You're not required to have an opinion of your abilities or of your quality as a human being. In fact, you tend to be better off if you don't have one, or if you learn not to care about what your opinion is. The reason is that you can't see you. You can't. You will never see yourself the way other people do. Good or bad, you will never see yourself the way other people do. And so having an opinion about yourself is one of the most useless things you can do. It's something that we're all trained to do, to worry very, very hard about whether we're good enough or we're doing the right things, because we're a social species and our standing in the tribe has a lot to do with our ability to survive and thrive. But you can't control the way you look to other people, the way you appear on the market, the way that your art strikes people, by looking at yourself. The only way you can do that is by looking at other people and noticing the way that they react to things. You can control the perceptions of other people by looking at it on that level, but that has nothing to do with your quality as an artist. Nothing at all. That's social manipulation. And the mistake that agreeable people make, and make no mistake, most artists are insanely agreeable people, which is one of the reasons that they do this. The mistake that most agreeable people make is to assume that what they feel about themselves has anything to do with what other people feel about them. It doesn't. They are two completely separate domains of life that only touch coincidentally. But where a disagreeable person will take from life the lesson that social manipulation is important, therefore I will make an effort to be nice at parties even though I really don't care about it. The agreeable person, and I'm talking about extremes here, the agreeable person will say, I have to be nice at parties. This means I need to be a very nice person. I need to be really genuine in everything I do, and I have to be very, very careful that nobody suspects that I might be thinking something else underneath, so I can't think those thoughts at all. Well, that's a way to drive yourself crazy. There's a lot of things about being a disagreeable person that can be a downside, but the ability to not give a fuck, to genuinely not give a fuck, not to not give a fuck as retaliation or revenge for someone doing something wrong to you, as a substitution for rage, that's actually giving a fuck and pretending apathy in order to get someone's goat. No, not giving a fuck is when you couldn't care less if they paid you to care less. Cultivating the ability to not give a fuck about your own opinion of your work in the self-worth sense that you're talking about, that's really, really worth developing because it's just emotional noise. It doesn't have anything to do with the quality of your work or the quality of you as a person or the quality of you as a force in the market. It just doesn't. And, like Kitty said, even Neil Gaiman deals with that. So, that's what I got. I really hope it's helpful. Thank you so much for sending it in, Melissa. Good luck. And I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty McKeon and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.